This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his New Testament History, Literature, and Theology course, lecture number 15, finishing up on prayer in the book of Luke in the Emmaus Road, and then proceeding into the synoptic problem. Well, welcome back. Today we are in the process of finishing our third or fourth lecture on Luke, and today we'll be done in just a few minutes on Luke. And then what I'd like to do is examine the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Those three are called the Synoptic Gospels, and we're going to look at them in kind of comparison, contrast type of thing in our next lecture, second part of this lecture. So let's finish up the book of Luke, and there was basically two things that I wanted to that we've missed so far in the book of Luke, and one of those is the nature of prayer in the book of Luke. And so what I just want to notice is some things here, like, for example, eight times Jesus prays in the book of Luke that are unique to Luke. So Luke, if you're looking for prayer, Luke is the gospel to go to. Eight times, seven are only found in this gospel. So Jesus prays eight times in Luke, seven of those times are unique to this gospel. So he has quite a bit to say about prayer, and kind of want to contrast that to Matthew's comments on prayer, asking you shall receive, seeking you shall find. And you've got to be careful with that kind of a statement in terms of some of the people will look at prayer as almost like a vending machine where you go up, you put your coins in, you pull the lever, and the candy drops down. And they kind of have a vending machine view of God and then a vending machine view of prayer, asking you shall receive. And they don't realize the complexities of prayer and things like that, just grabbing a simple statement out of Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, and then trying to absolutize that, which we said before, you've got to be really careful about absolutizing those statements and things. So Luke presents another side of prayer, and we just want to look at that. And there's two that I'd like to look at in particular. Both of them are found in Luke chapter 18. And actually what you have in Luke chapter 18 is two parables on prayer. So you have whole parables on prayer. And let me just read through the first one. This is the prayer of the Pharisee and the tax collector. And this is in Luke chapter 18, verse 9. It says, "To some who were confident in their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else." So that sets up this parable. Okay, they're confident in their own righteousness, and they look down on everyone else. So you can already see the kind of contrast. And then how is that kind of arrogance and that belittling of their fellow person, how is that going to play into prayer? Okay? So it starts out their attitude toward others, and then it's going to take it and shift that toward prayer. And Jesus told them this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. "God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even this," and then you can see the speaking kind of theoretically about that, "I'm glad I'm not like robbers, evildoers, adulterers," just speaking generically. But then he makes it much more personal, and this Pharisee turns to, "or even like this tax collector." And now he's getting close and to the person who's to his left or to his right, to this tax collector. "I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get." And so this is how this man prayed, in comparison of himself to everyone else, and basically bragging to God about his fasting twice a week and his paying a tenth of all he has, which is interesting because it does tell us something about the Pharisaic notion of religion, that the fasting was part of that, and they fasted twice a week, and they gave a tenth of everything they had. Now, it shifts then. "I'm thankful that I'm not like other people, adulterers, murderers, and this tax collector." And now we're going to hear from the tax collector. But the tax collector stood at a distance. You get the notion that the Pharisee is up front, close, and kind of like in front of people, but the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, and then this is what people call the Jesus Prayer. And this is one of the most significant prayers in Scripture. This is one that, I pray repeatedly, and people around the world pray repeatedly. It's a very short prayer,
It's a kind of a breathing prayer that you can breathe out to God in a very short space of time. And it says this. This is the Jesus prayer. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. He doesn't compare himself to anybody else. You notice that the Pharisee, when he was addressing God, was looking everywhere else. This tax collector, it's directly communication between he and God. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And then Jesus comments, I tell you the truth, this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. And what I think is interesting there is then this shows us that there's kind of some moral prerequisites to prayer. There's some moral prerequisites to prayer. And so this person, because he humbled himself, the tax collector humbled himself, God, be merciful to me, a sinner, he goes down justified. Very interesting, the word justified. This man, because of how he prayed, was considered justified before God. That the Pharisee was not in all his righteousness because he looked down on others and things. So this is a Jesus prayer. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And that stance, that humble stance, is a really critical stance that when one approaches God, that one approaches not in arrogance but in humility, pleading, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. So that is a that's a very short prayer. You've got the Lord's Prayer, Our Father which art in heaven. Many of us know that and things, but this is just a one-liner. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And I think it's appropriate for people to pray that often, frequently, daily, hourly, and actually minutely, if there's such a word. So humility is kind of a basis versus pride as a you know, the character quality of the person conditioning the response to the prayer. Now, there's a second prayer that comes up, and this one is the woman and the unjust judge. The woman and the unjust judge. And this is another parable from Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18 starts out with this one, and we'll just read through it. Then Jesus told his disciple a parable to show them that they should always pray and not give up. So this is about persistence in prayer, that they should always pray and not give up. And this I think, is a response I've been told at various points in my life that if you trust God, you make your prayer to God. He knows what's on your heart. He knows what's on his heart. So you don't have to ask him more than once. It's like he knows what you want. And you know, to say it over and over and over again just becomes vain babbling. And Jesus said, you know, don't pray over and over again. Idle repetitions kind of thing. But here Jesus talks about praying and always prayer and not give up. He said, and then he's going to tell a parable now, in a certain town there was a judge who neither feared God nor cared about men. And there was a widow in that town who kept coming to him with a plea. Notice Luke again picks up on the widow. Remember we said before in the previous lecture that Luke picks up on the widow and he picks up on the only child kind of thing. So here's a widow. Someone who's kind of disenfranchised in that culture, a needy person in that culture, is approaching a judge. What is a judge to do? A judge is to make justice for the widow, the orphans, and the fatherless, okay? And the poor, the foreigners. And so the judge is to take care of and make justice for those who cannot get justice in the society. So here you've got this widow coming before the judge. The judge is a person of status. She is a person of low status. And she comes to this judge, and he cares neither about God, doesn't fear God or care about men. And she says to him, and there was a widow in that town who kept coming to him, notice that kept coming to him, with a plea, grant me justice against my adversary. Now the fact of the matter is, this is the parable, so we don't know the whole story. We never do know what was it that was bothering her, what was this injustice that she was, and what was it that this adversary had done to her, or was doing to her. We don't know that. And so the parables don't tell you all the little interesting details that you'd like to know. A parable is a story, and it's got a point. And so this parable is directed to that point. And so we don't really know what the injustice was. But for some time, he refused. But finally, he said to himself, even though I don't fear God or care about men, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will see that she gets justice, so she won't eventually wear me out by her coming. Okay, end of parable. Then the Lord said, listen to what the unjust says, judge says. And will not God bring about justice for his chosen ones who cry out to him by day and night? Notice the crying out by day and by night. People keep coming back to God, crying out by day and by night. Will he keep putting them off? I tell you, he will see that they get justice quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? And then all of a sudden at the end of this parable, you've got this jump to the eschaton, to the final days. Okay. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? And it's an interesting jump there. They will get justice. And then he puts it in that eschatological, in that end of days kind of thing, that God will render justice, and then associates that justice with the final days there. So this has to do about persistence in prayer, praying the same thing and asking for the same thing over and over, and basically saying one ought always to pray and to not give up and not give up. And I think that's really an important thing. I think Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, people say, well, we shouldn't pray the same thing over and over again. Well, Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, do you remember that he went away three times and prayed each time, Father, if it's your will, take this cup from me. Okay? And Jesus asked God to take away the cup from him. Cup of sorrow, Judas is going to come to him and things. And he prayed three times for that. And then Judas comes and betrays him. Okay? Paul, in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul tells about his thorn in the flesh. Now, we don't really know what that thorn in the flesh is for sure. A lot of people have a lot of guesses on that. But Paul had this thorn in the flesh that was given to him by God. He prays three times, you know, Father, take this from me. That he prayed that the thorn in the flesh would be taken away. God didn't do it. So it's just, it's interesting. So this notion of praying persistently is a big thing in Scripture. We see Paul praying three times for something, Jesus praying three times for something. And so it's something we need to think about in prayer. The Psalms also, let me just say, the book of Psalms are largely prayers sung to God. And those Psalms would be sung over and over and over again at festivals and at feasts in Israel. And so this notion of asking and praying, many of your churches will pray the Lord's Prayer every Sunday. And we recite the Lord's Prayer. Some of us recite the Lord's Prayer almost on a daily basis. And so these are wonderful things, and prayer, continuing our conversation concerning that. I can kind of like it, and this is not a parable, but it's kind of like a parallel, let's say. And I think of my grandson, Ben. I think he was getting a bicycle for Christmas, and he basically would come to my wife, and every other line that he would come is he wanted this bicycle for Christmas. And so what happened is every time he would interact with my wife, it would kind of like this, whatever the incident was going on in the family, it would come down to, boy, I sure would like a bike for Christmas. I sure would like a bike. Have you gotten my bike yet for Christmas? What kind of bike did you get me? And it would always come back to that. And so I think that shows then his focus. He really wanted this thing. And so he, you know, as a young person, as a kid, it's like, you know, he's really thinking a lot about this bike. So then when he communicates with his grandparents in this case, it was, you know, where's the bike? What, you know, can you get me a bike for Christmas? And then that was done repeatedly. And of course, we didn't know what Santa Claus got him, but he probably got a bike that year. So, all right. Now, just down a little bit, praying when things matter. This is an interesting one for me. I think actually my son was one of the people who taught me how to pray. And I never, a lot of times I pray about things happening at Gordon College here, or relationships with students, or people that are, some students, you know, have problems. One kid's got a broken foot, another kid's suffering with coming between cultures and having a real hard time adapting cultures. Others have trouble with the language and are struggling with language. Others are struggling with relationships and relationships to their home family, relationships here at Gordon and things. And so you pray for people and you make requests for them. But in one sense, there's no skin in the game. And there's not, it doesn't, like, whatever God does will be okay kind of thing. And so you pray just to bring it in front of God. My son, who's a Marine, went to Afghanistan, and when he was in Iraq, he went to Iraq first a few years ago, and that wasn't quite as bad, I don't think, but when he went to Afghanistan, it got really bad. And when you basically, when you as a parent feel helpless, when you feel helpless, normally it's the parent's role, particularly the father, to protect his children. And when you can't protect and you have no control over what happens, and the person's getting shot at, and you know the record comes back, you know, you talk on the phone and saying, yeah, we got shot at every day, then you know, and other people, friends of his were actually killed and maimed and hurt and things like that, and you know it could be him and things, and you just pray, and you pray from the sense of helplessness, and you beg. You basically learn to beg God, to God spare the person's life. And then I remember in Abraham in the Old Testament bartered and said, you know, if there's 50 righteous, will you spare the city? If there's 40, 30, 20, 10, fine, if there's 10, please, will you spare the city? And I do remember doing the same thing and saying, God, if it's going to be him or me, take me instead of him. And I'm an old man, I'm ready to go and stuff, but spare the kid. And so you pray, begging, pleading, doing whatever you can, because it matters so much to you. And so that level of praying occurs, and I don't know whether you've had friends that you've prayed for. I think of other people. I've got a friend, Brian Kinney, who works for Baker Bookhouse. And Brian, outside of Baker Bookhouse, I've known him for a number of years and stuff, and his boy got leukemia. And so here's Brian with this young boy, I don't know, he's 5 or 6 years old, just a young kid. He comes down with leukemia, cancer in the blood kind of thing, and the kid's was on the verge of death. The doctors are doing wonderful things now, incredible things. And so we prayed, and there were a whole host of people praying for Brian Kinney's boy. And the doctors were successful. Now, I don't know, this is years later now, so I'm not sure but they were successful. And they went into remission, and he seemed to be doing all right. And the leukemia passed, and they got it. And it was just really exciting. We prayed for him for probably a year, praying for this young kid, and God spared his life. And it was just a wonderful thing. And you can see as a parent, and you know as a parent, when your kid gets some one of these fatal diseases, you just realize, you're in a different stance where, you know, you're praying for something that really doesn't matter that much. And then all of a sudden you pray and it really does matter. My daughter's got a husband now who's got a brain tumor inside of his ear, in his brain. And basically he's lost part of his hearing already. And he's a lawyer, so it really matters that he can hear. Although maybe you'd say as a lawyer he shouldn't hear, but anyways, he's got this thing in his brain, and they're afraid to go in and cut it because it's around the nerve, and it will also paralyze half his face, and there's all sorts of discussion and prayer. And so we pray for him on a regular basis now. And just so we should always pray. And there's so big things going on in the world that are to be prayed for. There was a man in Iran who was a Christian believer in Iran. And he was a pastor in Iran, and they basically said that he converted from Islam. You're not allowed to convert from Islam, from Islam to Christianity. He converted when he was a young kid. They made him basically say, you deny your faith or you're going to die. And he didn't deny his faith. And now the big question is, have they killed him already? And stuff. Yosef was his name. And, so you get these kind of things, and you pray for this man who's got a wife and kids and things like that is being put up to be killed for his faith, to die as a martyr. This is in the 21st century. He is dying as a martyr for his faith. And all he has to do is recant, but he won't do it because he's a Christian. He loves the Lord. And so these things are going on here, and there's need for prayer, desperate need for prayer. So, okay. So prayer is a big thing. Luke chapter 18, really nice, two parables on prayer there. And I think there's one other thing that I wanted to cover here in Luke, and that's to kind of finish it out. And this is the Emmaus Road. The Emmaus Road is a famous narrative when Jesus has risen from the dead, and basically his disciples then are just like, Jesus died on the cross, they're all really down, 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 And then after 3 days, he rises from the dead. And when he shows himself, some of the people see him, some of the people don't. You remember Thomas and stuff when we get into John, hadn't seen him yet himself, and so he questions things. This Emmaus Road is two individuals, and they're walking out from Jerusalem by themselves. They've been in Jerusalem for the death of Christ, and they've heard rumors of the resurrection, but they don't know what's really going on. And so they're walking a Sabbath day out to Emmaus Road. This is about, I don't know, 7 miles out of Jerusalem to the west. And so they're going on this road. I've had the privilege of walking on this Emmaus Road. It's an old Roman roads. The Romans built roads throughout the empire, and those roads are so good that they're still in existence today. Among many of them without potholes that they made out of slabs of stone, a really incredible road structure. This is from Luke chapter 24, starting with verse 13. It says, "Now the same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking with each other about everything that had happened." Okay, this is now Jesus has died, rumors of resurrection. "And as they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. But they were kept from recognizing him." So anyways, Jesus comes up, and Jesus is walking with them, but they don't know it's Jesus, because Jesus, you know, kind of does something. I don't know, he's wearing a hoodie or something, but they don't know who he is and stuff, and so then he talks. So he asks them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast, okay, still thinking Jesus was dead. "One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, 'Are you the only visitor in Jerusalem that does not know the things that have happened there in these days?'" "What things?" he asked, playing stupid kind of things, like, what's going on? Getting them to provide the information and things and seeing their perspective and what they're thinking. Well, Jesus, it's Jesus, okay? He asked them, "What things?" he asked them. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet." Very interesting. He was a prophet. What was their understanding of Jesus? "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to..." Now, what was the nature of their hope? This is a really kind of neat passage, because it tells us, these here are two Jewish people, this they're describing the nature of their hope that they had for the Messiah. And so here's their hope that they describe. "But we had hoped that he was the one who is coming to redeem Israel." So the point was of the Messiah was to redeem Israel, to throw off the Roman yoke, to set up the Son of David, to redeem Israel. "And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women..." Now he's going to tell about some of the rumors. "And in addition, some of our women amazed us, and they went to the tomb early this morning, but they didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive." Again, these women are reporting this stuff, so they'd heard the report, but they couldn't confirm it, so they're not sure. Did this happen or did this not happen? The body's gone. Where did these angels come from? By the way, does anybody remember in the beginning of the book of Luke? This is the last chapter of Luke. Does anybody remember the beginning of Luke? Who shows up? The angels show up at the birth of Christ announcing, you know, glory in excelsis Deo kind of thing. Glory in the beginning, the angels come and announce it to the shepherds, and now you've got angels here reported at the end of the book. "They didn't find the body. They came and told us they'd seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the woman had said, but him they did not see. So now the woman's report has been confirmed. His body's gone, but they still don't know what to make of this. "He said to them," now Jesus breaks in, "'How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets had spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and enter into his glory?'" So then Jesus raises from the prophets this notion that the Messiah needed to suffer, that it's not just necessarily the Messiah ben David who was going to rule on the throne, but Messiah ben Joseph, who is going to suffer, like Joseph suffered in prison, righteously and things. So now the Messiah was going to suffer. And this is possible reference to Isaiah 53, that he would bear our afflictions, our infirmities, and that he was like a lamb to the slaughter, and that he took upon us, on him, our iniquities were on him, Isaiah 53. "All we like sheep have gone astray." So, and then it says this, Did not Christ have to suffer these things, then enter into glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in the scriptures concerning himself. What a lecture that would have been, okay? Jesus starts with Moses. Notice he goes back to the Pentateuch. He goes back to Moses and all the prophets and explains then about the Christ. And as they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus acted as if he were going on further. But they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. And when he was at table with them, so now he sits down at table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. So now you've got Jesus sitting at table, breaking bread with them, giving thanks for bread. Does that remind you of anything? It's kind of like this is the post-Eucharist, the post-Lord's Supper now, and Jesus sitting down and breaking bread with them as he had broken bread with his disciples before. And now he's breaking bread again. And so notice what happens, okay? So then he was at table with them. He took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us as he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" Did not our hearts burn when he opened the scriptures to us? Beautiful. Beautiful saying. They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem, where they found the 11 and those with them assembled. So you had the 11 apostles and those assembled with them, apparently more than just the apostles and stuff. It is saying, "It is true, the Lord has risen and has also appeared to Simon." And the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. Now, I think there's one other passage that I want to bring up, and this is down in chapter 24, verse 44. And this is interesting to hear their description. And it says this. He said to them, this is Jesus speaking now, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written in..." And then he describes the Old Testament. And here's how he describes it. "Everything must that was a witness about me in the law, the prophets, and the Psalms." The law, the prophets, and the Psalms. And so in here in Luke chapter 24, verse 44, you have the threefold canon of the Old Testament. This is the Jewish canon. Moses, the Pentateuch, Genesis to Deuteronomy, the Torah. Then you've got the prophets, the former prophets, starting with Joshua, Judges, and Samuel's going through there. Kings, those are called the former prophets. The latter prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and the 12, okay? And so you've got Moses and the prophets and the Psalms. The other section of the Old Testament is the writings, of which Psalms is the chief, okay? Huge book, the Psalms. And so Jesus here mentions the threefold division of the Old Testament and explains to his people, then but they must speak these things about me in the law and the Moses, in the prophets, and in the Psalms. And he opened their minds so that they could understand the scriptures. And so this was after the resurrection, and Jesus goes through with his disciples, through Moses, the prophets, and the writings, or the Psalms. And so it's very, that's a key passage when you're thinking about canonical studies. The Old Testament was broken into these three sections, and those three sections are mentioned by Jesus after the resurrection. Well, that finishes the book of Luke for us, and now we've got Luke done. We take a step back now. We've been looking at Matthew, Christ as King. We've been looking at Mark, the amazing suffering servant. We've looked at Luke, the perfect man, Christ growing and things in various ways. And now what I want to do is jump over from the Emmaus Road, and I'm going to jump over to another whole section here. Let me actually get out of this, come back. And get up to, we're going to go into the synoptic problem now. And what is the synoptic problem? The synoptic problem is basically what happens when you compare Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so there's going to be similarities and there's going to be differences. Now, when there's similarities, there's no problem, okay? When the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all say the same thing, that's not really a problem. But these three Gospels seem to be very similar, so they call it synoptic. Anyway, you can synoptic. Soon in Greek means with, optic, like optician, ophthalmology, with one eye. Okay, so the synoptic problem says that these three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, see Jesus with one eye. John, on the other hand, John is totally different. John gives a totally different perspective. So kind of as you need two eyes to give you depth perception, and you have two eyes so that you can realize that chair is closer, the clock in the back of the room is much further, and you have depth perception because you have two eyes. They're actually developing now video cameras with two cameras shooting, and then almost like our eyes, to give the sense of, even in video camera work now, of this three dimensions now. It's really kind of neat what's happening. But what you have is Matthew, Mark, and Luke giving one perspective and John giving another one. Very different perspectives between the synoptics. But among the synoptics, those are all with the same eye, there's similarities, great similarities and great differences. And so we want to look at that. And so synoptic with one eye. With one eye, the three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, see Jesus with one eye. Now, what's interesting is that in the early church saw the differences between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and yet they didn't squash them together. They allowed each witness, Matthew is different than Mark, is different than Luke. They're very similar, but there's differences. Normally, if you would want some sort of agreement, you would think historically, if the text were malleable or if the text were plastic, you would expect people then to say, oh, we need to make Matthew and Mark agree. And so where they disagree, you'd have people harmonizing them, illegitimately harmonizing them, but that didn't happen. They left the differences, the early church left the differences in the text. And that tells me something about the historicity of these documents. It wasn't that, oh, okay, the church is playing around with these documents. These documents are very malleable, and they're just legends made up, and so you can tweak the legends to make them fit together. No, they didn't look at it that way. They looked at the documents that they had, and they left them stand. And they left them stand even at the points where there were major clashes. They left the clashes in. They didn't harmonize them. And so, very interesting, the early church didn't correct and harmonize and things like that. They left them stand with these differences, and we'll look at some of the differences in a minute. What does it say about their belief in the sanctity of the text and the historical reliability? The historical reliability of the text. As Christians, we are very linked in to history. Our theology rises out of history. It's not that our theology gives birth to history. No. It's history, real events happening. Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Jesus ministered in Galilee and walked on the waters in Galilee. Jesus died in Jerusalem and rose again on the third day. Those are historical events. And those historical events then, in other words, Christianity is built on real history. And then our theology comes off the history. So history is incredibly important. So the historical reliability of those three Gospels that tell us about Jesus are incredibly important. The same way for the Jewish people, that the book of Exodus and the Pentateuch are very important for them. The coming out of Egypt and God bringing them out of Egypt with a strong arm, an outstretched arm, and the mighty hand and things. So the New Testament, very historical reliable. They didn't squash things together. They didn't say, well, these legends don't agree, so we'll fudge them to make them fit better. They left them each stand. Why not legend? Okay. Part of the problem why the Gospels aren't legend is that you've got Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Mark writing probably before, 60 A.D.? And Luke writing before Paul was dead. Paul dies about 68. Luke writes to Most Excellent Theophilus, probably as a defense of the Apostle Paul. So it's probably before Luke is probably pretty firmly before 65. Matthew maybe a little bit after that, but all these guys writing in that before 70 AD kind of thing, and because the temple destruction is not mentioned in any of these Gospels, and so before 70 AD, well, that's what, 30, 40 years after Jesus, okay? Now you say a lot changes in 30, 40 years, but the problem is this, is 30 or 40 years time enough for a whole legend about Jesus to grow up? And the answer is no. The problem is you've got eyewitnesses still living. You've got eyewitnesses still living that can confirm Jesus either did this or Jesus didn't do this. And so because of the life of eyewitnesses, you can't fudge that stuff that much. Kind of reminds me of a woman named Sonia Weitz. We had her at Gordon College here for years. Dr. Marv Wilson, who's a kind of the legend at Gordon College, a phenomenal teacher, phenomenal individual that teaches here in Old Testament, he has developed a real integration with the Jewish community on the North Shore of Boston here. And he's gotten to know Sonia Weitz, and she was a Holocaust survivor. And so she would get up once a year, Marv and Polly would bring in Sonia Weitz, and she would give a lecture then at Gordon College on being a survivor. And she would describe the Holocaust, and actually I've got a video of this, and she would describe the Holocaust and what it was like for her. She and her sister, the rest of her family, I think, perished in the Holocaust, and she and her sister went to some of the major, I'm not sure whether Auschwitz and Buchenwald or which one it was, but she was to several of them, got on the train, was packed in a train car with like 200 people, and basically just totally humiliated and things like that. And she would describe the Holocaust. Now, what's the problem? People can't fudge on the Holocaust because there's still people alive. Sonia Weitz remembered the Holocaust. She was there. So when a guy like Akhmenijab or some crazy guy gets up in Iran and says, there was no Holocaust, that was all made up by the Jews. Sorry, Sonia Weitz was there. Okay. And by the way, even General Eisenhower, when they went in to free those camps and stuff, he said, people will never believe what happened here. And so he had that all those things documented. They took photographs and they documented that whole thing because he said people will never believe it. And so that is very well documented. Even with it well documented, you've still got crazy people saying it never happened and things. So, but the problem is that you can call those people's bluff because Sonia, she was there, she was an eyewitness, and she bears witness to the fact of what it was like to be in the concentration camps under Hitler. And so there's nobody can challenge her. That was her experience. She was there, she and her sister. The problem, now what's one of the problems? The problem is Sonia died just a few years ago, and so now she doesn't come and tell her story anymore, and so that's what's happening to a lot of the survivors of the Holocaust. They're dying out. And so, therefore, you don't have this witness now. And we're in, 2011, 2012 now. And the Holocaust happened, in the 1940s? So we're talking 60, 70 years there. And so now these people are dying off. Well, see, with Mark, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you're still back within the 20, 30, 40-year range. So there's plenty of people around who actually can witness to these events. So that's all I'm saying. So you don't have time for a legend. And you have too many people. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, there were 500 people that saw Jesus alive after he rose from the dead. 500 people, as well as the 12, and as well as the women, as well as these two people from the Emmaus Road. So how many witnesses, how many witnesses does it take before a person says, that really happened? You got two witnesses, you're pretty good. You got one witness, you may wonder. You got two witnesses, that ups the probability quite a bit. What do you got when you get 11 and 12 witnesses at a time? What happens when you get 500 witnesses all at one time, different places, different times, different settings? This Emmaus Road, he had never been probably down Emmaus Road before. There's no record of that in Scripture. And so these people have no association with Jesus in this area, and yet Jesus meets them on the road to Emmaus. So, and that's two of them, two witnesses. So it's not just one and thing. So, not legend, historical reliability. Now, things wouldn't be covered up like the disciples. If you were writing a gospel about Jesus, would you, as an apostle, you were one of the 12 guys, would you tell all the dumb things that the apostles do? Jesus is in a boat with them, and he starts telling them, beware the yeast of the Pharisees, and the disciples start saying, oh man, we forgot to take bread, and Jesus is getting mad at us because he didn't have anything to eat, so he's talking about the leaven of the Pharisees, but it's really that he's hungry because we forgot bread. And Jesus says, hey, get a clue. If I want bread, how many did I just feed? I just fed 5,000, man. If I want bread, I can make bread, manna from heaven. God gave manna from heaven. If I want manna from heaven, we can do that, okay? And he says, you don't understand the disciples. So the disciples are played at a certain point as not understanding Jesus over and over and over again. They just didn't get it. Now, if you were the one writing that and you were one of the apostles, wouldn't you delete those kind of stories and that just made your friends, the people that you hung out with for those years? Many of those people who are now in the process of going out spreading the gospel are getting killed. And would you tell those negative stories about them? But yet the gospel exposes the disciples, and they're just not getting it, not understanding it. Jesus eating with tax collectors and things. You'd think that they'd want it to up his status and stuff, and rather than having him hang around with these illegitimate women like Mary Magdalene and the tax collectors, you'd put him out there with, you know, the Herods and the Caiaphas, the high priest, and the Pontius Pilates, and you'd have him hanging out with the bigwigs. But instead, who does he hang out with? These tax collectors and sinners, and we don't even know many of their names and stuff, but that Jesus had a reputation for, the Samaritans. Again, the same thing. If you're a good Jewish person, why would you feature the Samaritans when you know that's offensive to all the Jewish people and things, and yet the Gospels keep coming back to this. Jesus hung out with the Samaritans. It gives you true history, even though knowing that true history is going to be offensive to some people. In other words, Jesus was not necessarily politically correct. And so he talks about his relationships with the Samaritans, even knowing that would bring opposition. The unbelief of the disciples, his own disciples, did not believe in him at points. His own family, coming to take Jesus away because they thought his own family members, James and Joseph and his mother, they're coming to take you away. They're coming to take you away. And so they come to take Jesus away because he's crazy. They think he's crazy. And his own brothers, just reading in another passage where they were, and this is from the book of John, sorry for jumping to John, but John, they're going up to the Feast of Tabernacles. And his brothers say, hey, Jesus, hey, why don't you do your miracles that you do? Why don't you go down to Jerusalem and show everybody these miracles you do? And then the comment of the narrator in John says, because his own brothers and sisters, his own brothers did not believe in him. His own brothers, they say, hey, go down to Jerusalem, do these miracles. Because they didn't believe in him. And those kind of things, if you were writing a history of a hero, you would cover those things up. You would cover them up. Peter denies the Lord. Peter's going to be one of the big guys in the early church. I mean, this is the Apostle Peter. This is the Peter, upon this rock I will build my church. And yet the Gospels record Peter denies the Lord three times. What kind of a... If you were writing a history, wouldn't you skip things of your friend Peter and just say, okay, he made some mistakes? You don't feature the mistakes of your friends in the way you write your history. But yet the gospel has Peter denying the Lord just before his crucifixion. Just before his crucifixion, three times denying him. Not just once, three times. And Peter going out and weeping because of that stuff. You would cover those kind of things up. And what I'm trying to say is the gospels give us accurate history. That they put out the good, the bad, and the ugly. And there's some ugly stuff there. They put that out there. And so this is real history. This isn't made-up history. This isn't ideal legendized history or mythological history that they make this myth. They make Jesus into this myth. No, they give you the real history. And so the historical reliability, this guy named Craig Blomberg, out at Denver Seminary, has written a really nice book, 400-500-page book on the historical reliability of the Gospels. Really critical book. I mean, if you're wondering about this stuff, he goes through and establishes a lot of the historical reliability of the New Testament, and particularly the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels. Craig Lomberg's book, Historical Reliability of the Gospels and stuff, really worth reading. So, now, let's look at some of the Synoptic Gospels here, some of the similarities. We said there's going to be similarities and differences in the Synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The similarities don't bother us. And so let's look at those. Those are pretty easy ones. But I just want to bring some of them up because I think it's important to notice at what level the similarities happen. There's kind of a broad chronological similarity. All the Gospels have this broad chronological framework. Jesus is born in Bethlehem of Judea. He grows up in Nazareth in Galilee. So Jesus... born in Bethlehem, goes to Nazareth. Nazareth is where he grows up under Joseph. His father's a carpenter. All of them, you know, this early ministry, but Jesus growing up in Nazareth and things. And then Jesus going to Galilee, going over to the Sea of Galilee, where he's calling his disciples, doing his ministry, healing people, walking on water, feeding 5,000, doing sermons on the mount kind of thing, healing lepers, healing demoniacs doing all this kind of stuff. So Jesus goes from Nazareth over to Galilee. Galilee is where he has much of his ministry. And then from Galilee, he goes down to Jerusalem. Now when he goes down to Jerusalem, that's getting ready for the end. This is the Passion Week. The Passion Week, he's going to go down to Jerusalem, and this is where he's going to be crucified. So all of them have this kind of, all of them have Jesus' death. 3 days later, his resurrection. Okay? So that broad framework, historical framework, Nazareth to Galilee, Galilee ministry with disciples and miracles and parables and teachings and things, then sliding down to Jerusalem for the end, and then hitting Jerusalem with the Passion Week, being crucified, dead, and buried, and resurrecting from the dead 3 days later. All Gospels have that same broad chronology. Okay, so that, and again, we're not surprised they're all recording what happened, but they all agree on that broad chronology. Some wording of many passages. Some of the wording in the passages is exactly the same, exactly to the point of being stunningly exacting. And so what we have here, and I want to look just at this parable of the paralytic. Okay, this guy with the paralytic, and just let me frame the story. You all know the story. Jesus is in a, he's teaching. He's in a guy's house, and there's a crowd out there, and these guys are bringing this guy, he's crippled, and he's brought by his four friends. So his four friends are carrying this guy on a mat, and they can't get into Jesus. The crowd is this sell-out crowd and stuff. So they, what are they going to do? They got this guy who's crippled. They got to get him into Jesus so Jesus can heal him. You remember the story. They go up on the roof. They take the roof apart. The roofs were flat in that culture, and they basically flat roof, made out of mud and branches and things, a lot of that. Didn't have real good shingles like we have in New England and real steep roofs and stuff, flat roofs. They go up, they take the roof apart, and you can imagine Jesus sitting there and all this dirt falling down on him. But anyways, this guy, and then boom, right through the roof, they drop this guy down in front of Jesus. Jesus looks at the guy and says, hey, you're, everybody's expecting Jesus to say, get up and walk. Jesus doesn't say that. Jesus never does what you expect. And so Jesus looks at the guy and says, your sins are forgiven. And everybody freaks out, or some of the people there freak out and say, whoa, who can forgive sin but God? Exactly the point. And Jesus says, your sins are forgiven. And then Jesus says, which is harder, to say your sins are forgiven or get up your mat, take your mat and walk? Apparently, taking your mat and walk proved that he could forgive sins. So Jesus says, get your mat, get up, get out of here. Guy stands up, walks out, boom. And by the way, small town, small town. Would everybody in the town know this guy was a cripple, probably, you know, and how he was made cripple and the whole situation with the family? In small towns, everybody knows everything. And so this guy walks out, and they're all stunned, okay? And so this is the story of the paralytic. But what we're looking here at is, I want to look at the particular text exactly of the wording. And this is Mark chapter 9, verse, Matthew chapter 9, verse 6. Matthew 9, 6, and it says, but so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, ... break in the text, so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sin, ... break then, he breaks. You may know the Son of Man may have authority on earth to forgive sins. Then he turns to the paralytic, exactly at the point, after saying that you may know, then he turns and he says to the paralytic, get up and walk. Okay, so there's a break right here. And I just want to look at that break where he breaks away from his talking to the crowd, and boom, he turns to this guy who's paralytic. And that's exactly what happens. If you look over at Mark chapter 2, it says, but that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sin, ... And then again, exactly at that place, he turns to the paralytic and he says, you know, pick up your mat and get out of here. Okay? So it's, but the break is exactly at the same point. And then, of course, we're showing similarities in Luke chapter 5, verse 24. It says, but that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, ... break, that you may know, boom, he turns to the paralytic and says, get up and walk. He turns to the paralyzed man. So you can see that in all three of these narratives, Jesus breaks at exactly the same point. What I'm trying to say is then, these are the synoptic gospels. They tell the stories, a lot of these stories, they tell in exactly the same way. The wording is exactly, and the movement even, between addressing the crowd and turning to the paralytic, exactly at the same point. And so this is, you know, verified three gospels exactly the way it happened there. So, now, that's one similarity. Here's another similarity. And this is the quote about John the Baptist. John the Baptist, early forerunner of Jesus, he is Elijah who is to come. Jesus said, if you'll receive it, this is Elijah who is to precede the Messiah, coming of the Messiah. And so John the Baptist says there's Old Testament quote. And so it says, this is he who is spoken of through the prophet Isaiah, a voice of one calling in the desert. And what does he call? He calls, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight paths for him. So there's a voice of one calling in the desert. Where did John hang out? John hung out in the desert. Okay, John hung out in the desert. He ate locusts and wild honey, and he hung out in the desert. And basically, so it's saying, Isaiah said, I believe it's Isaiah 40, he said, spoken, the voice of one calling in the desert. So he's out in the desert, and what does he call? Prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight paths for him. That is a quote coming from the LXX, or what's called the Septuagint. The Septuagint is a Greek translation of the Old Testament done about 200 to 100 B.C., okay? I don't want to get into all that stuff about when exactly, but about 200 to 100 B.C., the Septuagint actually be a little bit earlier, but anyways, okay. The Septuagint, okay? And notice, then, Matthew 3:3, Mark 1:3, and Luke 3:4, okay? So basically 3:4 and 3:3 in Matthew and Luke, almost the same chapter and stuff, it has this quote, and they all quote from the Septuagint. None of them, here's the quote in the Old Testament from the Masoretic text. Now, what is the Masoretic text? The Masoretic text is the Hebrew Old Testament. The Masoretic text, or we call it the MT. The MT is the Masoretic text. It is the Hebrew text. And that's why a lot of, Old Testament scholars, they learn how to read Hebrew. They also learn how to read Greek, so they can read the Septuagint. You can compare them, the Greek and the Hebrew, and see how the translators, about 200 B.C., how they did the translation work between them. But it's interesting, when the gospel writers go to quote it, they all quote from the Septuagint, and they all then do not quote from the Hebrew text. Here's how this passage is framed from Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3. A voice of one calling, in the desert prepare a highway for the Lord. Now, do you see the difference there? This is saying, a voice of one calling, and then what does he say? He says, in the desert prepare a way of the Lord. So that it's the way of the Lord that's going to be in the desert. But when you look at the Septuagint, it says the voice of one calling in the desert. So in the first case, in the Septuagint, it's the person who's calling is in the desert. Whereas in the Masoretic text, it's just a voice of one calling, and what does he call? In the desert, prepare a way of the Lord. It's the way of the Lord that's in the desert. So in the one, the speaker is in the desert, and he calls, prepare the way of the Lord. In the other one, it's prepare a way of the Lord in the desert. So the way of the Lord is in the desert. So these are definitely different readings then between the Septuagint and the Greek and the Hebrew Masoretic text. And so what it's saying is then that they all three Gospels, Synoptic Gospels, they all switch over to the Septuagint and they all ignore the Hebrew reading of the text there. So very interesting, all three are in agreement on there. Word for word, word perfect, okay? To quote a software package, okay? Word perfect. So the similarities. These are striking similarities. Striking similarities, they're exactly word for word kind of things. Very similar. Now, I want to work with this guy named Westcott who showed comparisons between, and we want to look at how many things are similar, how many things are different. And so I want to put up this kind of a chart, and we're going to look at, how much of Luke or Mark was different and how much of Mark was similar to the other Gospels. So the differences are going to be the differences from the other Gospels. Similarities are going to be when they overlap, when they're similar. In Mark, 7% of Mark is unique to Mark. 7% of Mark is different than the other Gospels. 7%. That means if you lost the book of Mark, how much would you lose? You'd lose about 7%. Okay? Which means then that 93% of Mark, this is huge, 93% of Mark is found in the other Gospels. And a lot of New Testament scholars today, there's some divergence on this, there's some argumentation on this, but most many, let me not say most, but many New Testament scholars will hold to a Markan priority, as they call it. That, in other words, Mark came first, and Matthew and Luke used Mark. So Mark came first, and then Matthew and Luke drew on Mark. They call that Markan priority, that Mark came first. And here's one of the reasons why they do that. Not the only reason, certainly, but this is one of them, that Mark, so much of Mark is found in the other Gospels. 93% of it is picked up in Matthew and Luke. That's incredible. So most of Mark is found elsewhere. Now, Matthew, 42% of Matthew is unique to him, and 58% of Matthew is similar, so that Matthew shares with other Gospels, 58%. 42% is unique. So that's 42%. That's quite a bit, okay? And you look at some of the things in the Olivet Discourse and other things in Matthew, they are unique. Luke, you'll notice this is edging up. Luke is now almost 60% unique. But nevertheless, 41% is basically is found in other Gospels. So Luke is about, 60-40. 60% unique, but 40% overlap. So this still quite a bit of Luke is found elsewhere. And so that these three Gospels, now you see, are very similar to each other, especially Mark. Now, let's look at John. John, we said, is not one of the synoptic Gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the synoptic Gospels. John's totally different. John is 92% unique. 92%. You see that? That's incredible compared to these three. You can see why these three are paralleled. And John, 92% of John is found nowhere else. Totally unique to John. And only 8% of the book of John is found in these other three Gospels. And that's why John is giving you a different perspective. It's interesting, actually, the John and Mark roles almost reverse. 8% is similar to John, is similar to the other Gospels, but Luke, Mark has only a 7% unique to him. Matthew has 92% unique to him. Most of Mark is found elsewhere, and so there's almost like a flip-flop back on those. But John's very unique. John's very unique. And so these three are the synoptic Gospels, and this one, John's John. Okay, so this is just kind of a comparison of how much there's overlap. And we said there's a lot of overlap with Mark, and not so much, and totally not much with John. Now here's another way to look at it. If you do these, you remember these Venn diagrams from when you're in high school and things, probably try to forget this Venn diagram stuff, but it actually comes in pretty handy here in comparing these three things, okay? So you've got Mark, only 50 verses of Mark are kind of unique. Matthew has 280, Luke has 500 unique. So you can see Luke, of the three, Luke is the most unique, Mark is the most not unique, and Matthew's got his own substantial stuff. But here, there's 480 segments here, 480 segments that overlap. All three have these 480 and similarities in common, they overlap. And then here between Mark and Matthew, about 180 is shared between Mark and Matthew, but not in Luke. Okay, this is outside Luke. This is just shared by Matthew and Mark, but 180 segments there. Mark and Luke share uniquely outside of Matthew about 20. So this is not very much at all. Luke shares with Mark 20 segments. And then 170 units are shared by Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. So most of Mark is found elsewhere, only 50 verses or 50 segments not. 170 shared between Matthew and Luke. And we call this 170 is going to be called Q. We'll see this in a minute, what Q is. We're going to call that the quella, the source. And this is the source that's shared. This is the material here, Q, that's shared by Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. So it's outside Mark, and that's what they call the Q source. In other words, that there was a source that Matthew and Luke had that Mark didn't have, and Matthew and Luke drew on that Q source to provide the 170 segments there. Now, differences. We talked about the similarities And the similarities usually are not a problem. Everybody kind of agrees with the similarities and they show similarities, but the differences cause people problems, okay? This is called the synoptic problem. What do you do with the differences, okay? And so one of the differences will be the ordering of events. The ordering of events. And this is, I think, significant. The temptation of Christ. Do you remember the temptation of Christ? Christ, in almost all the Gospels, starts right out. Jesus, the Spirit of God, comes and takes Christ out into the wilderness. He's where he's fasting 40 days, 40 nights out in the wilderness. Okay, this temptation sequence. And Matthew and Luke. Luke 4, Matthew 4. Temptation of Christ. Okay, here's the order. Both of these Gospels start out with Satan comes up to Jesus and says, Jesus, hey, you hungry? Turn those rocks into bread. And Jesus says, what? Man does not live by bread alone. Jesus quotes from Deuteronomy. Actually, all three times Satan tempted him, he quotes from Deuteronomy 4 to, I think it's chapter 11 or chapter 8, something like that in that section from chapter 4 on in Deuteronomy. So both gospel writers start out with the rocks to bread. Now you say there's no problem there. That's right, no problem there. What about the second one? In Matthew, it says that Satan took Jesus up to the pinnacle of the temple and basically said, Jesus, hey, the Psalms say that if you throw yourself down, that his angels will bear you up, lest you dash your foot up on a stone. And Jesus turns and says, don't tempt the Lord your God, again out of Deuteronomy. Satan's quoting Scripture here, as I think we mentioned before. Satan actually quotes Scripture and says, pinnacle, jump off the pinnacle, and his angels will bear you up. But what's interesting is Luke, on the other hand, talks about the kingdoms that Jesus, Satan takes him for the second temptation, takes him up to the mountain and to the high point of the mountain, shows him all the kingdoms of the world and says, I will give all these things to you if you'll bow down and worship me. And Jesus says, you know, you should worship only the Lord your God. Again, quoting from Deuteronomy. So here's the kingdoms that up on top of the mountain shows him the kingdoms of the world, worship me. And stuff. So you can see that the order is different. And sure enough, they both finished. There's three temptations, and each one of these have three temptations. Okay? But the three temptations, numbers 2 and 3, are switched, are flipped. So Matthew ends with Jesus being taken up to the mountain and shown all the kingdoms of the world, and says, all these kingdoms I'll give you if you bow down and worship me. And Jesus says, no, worship God only. Matthew ends with the kingdoms, whereas Luke ends with the pinnacle jump. Jump off this pinnacle, and I'll, you know, and his angels will bear you up. So all I'm saying is, the three temptations of Christ when he's tempted by Satan in the wilderness, numbers 2 and 3 are flip-flop. The order is different. So which one is the actual order? Which one is the actual historical order? Now, I want to bring another thing into this. Is it possible that the writer is using the order of this temptation of Christ in order to make a statement, in order to fit? In other words, did the writer fit his story? Did the writer fit his story to the environment of what he's trying to say? And what I'm wanting to suggest is, yes, do you guys realize storytelling, okay? When a person tells a story, do they tell it in different ways depending on the audience that they're addressing? We have this guy at Gordon College named Dr. Graham Bird. He's a pianist who plays classical piano. He's an incredible pianist. He's also a classical scholar, studies Homer and Greek and that kind of thing, as well as a linguist, and also involved in computers. He's kind of a Renaissance kind of person. They still have some of those people left in the world. And it's very interesting. He sits down and he calls what he calls it jazz, okay? And so he sits down with this metaphor on jazz. And so what happens is he'll play something like, let's take a song like Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. And so he'll play it. And what he'll do is then he'll take the song Amazing Grace and he'll play it in a classical style, in the style of kind of Beethoven or Mozart. And all of a sudden you'll hear him doing his little playing, and it will sound, you will recognize that it's Amazing Grace, but you will recognize also that he's playing it like a class, like it was a classical piece. And then all of a sudden he will switch and play that from Amazing Grace played as a classical piece, and then all of a sudden he'll switch and play Amazing Grace as if it's a gospel song in a kind of a Baptist, First Baptist church and stuff, and he'll start beating on the piano and start playing Amazing Grace like it would be in a Baptist church kind of context. And then, all of a sudden, he'll change. Again, you recognize both classically that it was Amazing Grace and when it was played as a gospel kind of song, Amazing Grace. And then, all of a sudden, he'll turn it into jazz. And it's almost like you're down in New Orleans and this guy is out on the street side there playing this song, Amazing Grace. Now, by the way, do you recognize it as it's jazz? You recognize immediately that it's jazz, but you also recognize that the song is Amazing Grace. Now, each one of those was Amazing Grace, but they were played totally differently. And you can see he could play in a classical audience, he would play it this way. In a gospel audience, he would play it this way. If you're down in New Orleans, he'd play it this way. Same song, but different. And anybody that's taught much, when I was younger, I taught at a Bible college down in Bristol, Tennessee, and I was a pastor, preaching at five different churches. And so I had five churches, and every week I would go to a different church and preach, okay? So it was like a circuit rider preacher. And so I would go from one church to the next, and would go five, and then I'd go around like that. So what happened is I developed a sermon, and I would preach the sermon. Now, at the first church, I would preach it, and then the second next week, I would preach the same sermon at a different church. A third time, I would preach at a third church, fourth and fifth church. I'd preach the same sermon 5 weeks and do it at five different churches, five different audiences. Now, question. Each time I preached the sermon, was it the same sermon? It was the same sermon all five times, but my wife would go with me to these various churches and things, and she'd always say, the first time you preached it, it was pretty terrible, okay? And so, okay, you go off the first time, she says, the first time is down, you didn't really have it together and stuff. She said it got much better the second time. She said the third time, you were the best. The third time, you had really honed it, and you preached it really well. She said by the fourth and fifth time, she said, especially the fifth time, she said, I could tell you were bored with your own sermon. And so there was kind of like a crescendo coming up. It was terrible initially. It got better, better. And finally I got it right. And then after I got it right, it was downhill from there. And so I'm saying is the same sermon preached in five different churches, did I ever use exactly the same words? Some, but with each church were the stories a little different? Did things get tweaked a little bit? Some depended upon the audience interaction and some depended on my crafting of the sermon to a different level, editing it again. And things. And so all I'm saying is it's possible to tell the same story several different ways. This has also come up. My son got back from Afghanistan and he tells stories, and I've heard his stories now told several times. And it's been very interesting. Each time he tells a story, he tells it one time to his brothers and sisters, and he tells a story, and everybody's laughing, rolling on the floor. It's just that he's an amazing storyteller. And he tells a story, and it's really humorous. The children leave the audience and the thing, and then he talks just to my wife and I, and then he tells us the same story, but with totally different meaning, and just drops some really, really heavy stuff. And it's the same story, but told with different effect on the audience and stuff. So storytelling is important. And what you have here is then, let's look at this. What's Matthew doing with the story? Matthew takes this temptations of Christ, rocks to bread. Well, why do they start there? Jesus has been fasting for 40 days, so the first question he's going to ask him is, do you want something to eat? Okay, so they all start with rocks to bread. But notice how Matthew ends with kingdom, shows him all the kingdoms of the world, bow down and worship me. Matthew chapter 4, this is all the kingdoms and worship me. What does chapter 5 of Matthew go into? Matthew chapter 5 goes into the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those that are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. It's the Sermon on the Mount. So after chapter 4, you've got this going into the Sermon on the Mount. Teachings about the kingdom. Teachings about the kingdom in the Sermon on the Mount. So Matthew sets up the teachings of the kingdom by ending the temptation of Christ with the kingdoms of this world, bow down and worship me. And then, boom, the kingdoms of this world? Well, now Jesus will tell you about his kingdom. His kingdom is found in the Sermon on the Mount, as he describes kingdom living. Okay, so Matthew, I don't know whether it switches in its original order, we don't know for sure, but Matthew, you can see it fits perfectly into the narrative, how Matthew's going to pick it up. Jesus is now going to teach on the kingdom in chapter 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount. So Matthew's story, the three temptations of Christ, ends with that kingdom, and then Matthew's going to teach, Jesus is going to teach on the kingdom. Now what about Luke, you say? And actually, this is the first year I've seen this, but Luke starts with the rocks to bread, of course, because Jesus is hungry. The kingdoms of the world is offered, the second one, but the pinnacle of the temple, take yourself off the pinnacle temple and throw yourself off, and his angels will catch you and bear you up. I never saw this before, but I looked because I saw this, how this bled from one into the other. I said, I wonder if Luke ends with this pinnacle jumping off the pinnacle. I wonder if there's a connection to what follows in Luke. And sure enough, guess what? Luke has Jesus going to the synagogue in Nazareth, teaching in the synagogue in Nazareth. Nazareth was his hometown. The people in his hometown reject him, and they take him off to the cliff that's overlooking the Armageddon Valley, the Jezreel Valley. They take him from Nazareth out to this cliff, and they are going to throw him off the cliff. So Jesus is going to be thrown or jumped off the cliff and be thrown down exactly the way this is the pinnacle. Get on the pinnacle and jump off. His angels will bear you up. And then what you have is this story of Jesus taking to the cliff and going to be thrown off the cliff. So it seems to me the story of Luke then, this pinnacle jump, leads right into Luke's next story of Jesus teaching in Nazareth and the conclusion of that his own people in Nazareth would reject him and take him to the pinnacle, and they're going to throw him off. And so what I'm suggesting here is that this is beautifully crafted literature. In other words, the guy tells a story, and he crafts the story to make it fit with, he connects story to story. These stories are organically connected. One flows into the next one, and they're crafted so that they flow one to the next. So this is okay. So there is a difference of order here. So you could say contradiction in Scripture, the order is different. There's a reason why the order is different. And it seems to be that this is how they're each wanting to tell the story. So the order of the temptation is not the important point here. The point is the temptation of Christ. So this is a difference in order. And we've got a clear example of that. Now, here, let's go next. Some other differences. Here is a difference in quotation. This is a difference of quotation. What was on the title? What was on the title of, over Jesus' head as he hung on the cross? What was the on the cross over Jesus' head? What was over Jesus' head as he was on the cross? And what we can do is pull up the various Gospels. We'll pull up the Gospels, and it tells us then this title was put on Jesus over the cross when he was hung on the cross. Matthew, chapter 27, verse 37. The title above the cross says, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Okay, that's what kind of what you'd expect. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Sounds pretty natural. This was the title that was put on the cross on Jesus. Matthew 27, 37. What does Mark say? Mark says, Mark drops the "this is Jesus," and Mark just has "the King of the Jews." He drops the first part, but he keeps the King of the Jews. Now you say, well, you know, you expect Mark to be shorter. The book of Mark is quite a bit compressed and shorter, so that Mark drops this, you say, But then you ask, what was really on the cross, you know, over his head? Okay, what was on the title over Christ's head? Mark drops, "This is Jesus, King of the Jews." So they're different. All I'm trying to point out is that they're different. The quotations of what was on this title over Christ's head were different. Luke comes out like this in chapter 23, verse 38. Luke says, "This is the King of the Jews." Now, Matthew said, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Luke says, "This is the King of the Jews," and drops out the name Jesus. So now what happens here is you have three different readings, and therefore I ask you in the resurrection, therefore, which one of these readings was really over the head of Christ? Now you say, well, Matthew seems to get the most, you know, so we pick the biggest one because the other ones can be condensed out of that. But you see, there's differences here. That's, my point is, you have a quote of what was on the title over Christ's head, and there are three different recordings of what that exactly was. So they're different in things. Now you say, wait a minute, Hildebrand, what about John? Yeah, guess what? Would you expect John to be different? Sure enough, he is. In John, the title above the cross over Jesus' head says, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. So you say, well, they all have the King of the Jews, so the King of the Jews must be on there. Yes, but did it say this is Jesus? Did it say nothing? Did it say this is, and drop Jesus' name, and just this is the King of the Jews? Or did it say Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews? There's four different readings now for what was on the cross over Jesus' head. So, all I'm saying is, sometimes when you have quotes, and let me just make a bigger point. Sometimes when you're in the New Testament, and it says, Jesus said, what's the problem? It's not giving you the exact words of Jesus. It's giving you a summary of what he said. And they're summarizing sometimes in their own words. The same way that you, if you went to Lane, go to lunch, and you'd say, hey, you should hear what Prof. Phillips says. Prof. Phillips says this. You aren't quoting her word for word. You're summarizing what she said. And you're summarizing oftentimes in your own words. And so what you may have then is that you've got to be careful. These aren't quotes like technical quotes, like every word is exactly, you know, exactly what he said and things. So how do you account for these differences? Well, some of it could be they're just saying basically what's on the title on the cross and things. It's very likely, and actually we know from the records, that the title on the cross was in three languages. The title on the cross was in three languages. And so you've got basically Greek and Aramaic up there. So one of these would be in Greek, one of these would be in Aramaic, and another in a different language. And so you had three different languages. Is it possible then that in three different languages they had different titles? In other words, it wasn't word for word, and that in the different languages they had different titles. And so what you have here is each person then copied a different one of those languages up there, and the three different languages weren't the same. That's possible. Okay, that's possible. Okay, and so the three different languages with three different, you know, descriptions above the cross, that's possible. Let me just push that a little bit further. When in your Bibles you have the red letter Bible, this is what Jesus said, and what Jesus said is in red letters. What's the problem with that? What language did Jesus speak in? Jesus spoke in Aramaic. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Talitha kum, he says to the little girl, get up. Jesus spoke Aramaic. Our New Testament is written in what? Our New Testament is written in Greek. So what you have in the New Testament is a translation of what Jesus said. Jesus spoke in Aramaic to his disciples, okay? And what you have in the New Testament is a translation into Greek of what he said. And it's very possible, and it is likely if you've done any translation work, you know, different translators translate things differently. Different translators translate things differently. And it's not whether one's right or one's wrong, it's just they translate it differently. So Jesus taught in Aramaic what we've got in the New Testament, so it's in Greek. And so you've got to make an allowance for that. I mean, they're not going to have, quote, exact quotes from Jesus because Jesus spoke in a different language. It'd be like somebody, you know, speaking in Spanish, and then it gets translated into English. Well, different translators are going to translate it differently. And you say, this is what, you know, Pablo says. And you quote him in Spanish, but you're quoting him in English. Well, Pablo really said, you know, que pasa or something. And you're going to translate that into English in different ways. So, okay. So you need to keep that in the back of your mind when you think about this. Some of the differences may be accounted for and are translational problems. Some of them may be that the different languages are reflected in the translation. And then others may be the purpose of the writer. The purpose of the writer didn't need to do it a certain way or wanted to make a point with something and did it that way. So there's variation in quotation, and you gotta be aware of that. Peter's quote, who do you say that I am? And you can go through Peter's quote, you know, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Well, if you take Peter's quote and you trace it through the other Gospels, you'll see there's, again, variation in quotation. So there's variation in quotation. And by the way, I just challenge you, think about how you quote your own friends when you say, so-and-so said this. And you're not quoting them word for word. You're giving summaries of it. One other thing, I should just say this too, in terms of Jesus' words and that kind of thing. Think about the sermons. Remember back in Matthew, we talked about the five great discourses in the book of Matthew. The five great discourses of Matthew. How long does it take you to read the Sermon on the Mount? Sermon on the Mount is Matthew 5, 6, and 7. How long does it take you to read that? Well, if you were to read it out loud, and my Greek students could do it out loud in Greek, it would take you probably about 10 minutes to read the Sermon on the Mount. Now, how many of you really think that when Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, that sermon was 10 minutes long? I want to tell you, when Jesus gave a sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, I want to suggest to you that it was much longer than 10 minutes. And so Jesus probably gave a sermon for what, half an hour, an hour? Some of those people, when they gave sermons in the ancient times, they gave sermons for hours. And what we have, we've got 10 minutes. We've got 10 minutes of what Jesus said there. We don't have the hours or the hour that he gave. By the way, we know that to be true. Do you remember we're reading in the book of Acts right now. You guys are reading in the book of Acts. And you remember in the book of Acts, I think it's, what is that, chapter 19 or 20 in the book of Acts. You've got, it's chapter 20, I believe. You've got Eutychus. And Paul gives a sermon, at Ephesus or someplace in Turkey there. And Paul's giving this sermon, and Paul's sermon goes so long, it kind of is like this class sometimes, that the sermon goes so long that this Eutychus guy falls asleep in the windowsill, and he actually falls out the window because he fell asleep during Paul's sermon, and Paul's got to go out and raise this guy up from the dead kind of thing, because the guy broke his neck or whatever, and so Paul heals this guy from falling out the window because his sermon was so long, and the guy was tired. And things. So all I'm trying to say is when it says Jesus' words, when you have these great discourses of Jesus, the Olivet Discourse is only two chapters. The discourse of sending of the 12 is one chapter long. But these, what we're getting is a three-minute synopsis or abstract or condensation of this sermon that probably would have gone on for a half hour, an hour long, but we've only got that much of it. So be careful when you say, who do men say that I am? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God, okay? And the other, there'll be variations on that. Because they're not giving you, don't think of it in terms of quote, quotes. Okay, they're giving you summaries, abstracting what was said there. So, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, okay? Here is Mark. You are the Christ. Now, you notice that he drops off. Again, Mark is shorter. Mark kind of gets to the point. You're the Christ, drops off the Son of the living God. And Luke says, the Christ of God, the Christ of God. So Luke kind of takes the Christ here, God, and kind of puts it together in his own way. Okay? So all I'm saying is be careful of the quotes. Okay, the quotes, there's variational differences. Some of that may be due to the fact that Jesus spoke in Aramaic, and these are different translations of it. Some of it may be compositional problem, not problems, but just the writer, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are trying to do something different with each one of them. So it would have to do with the composition of the writer. And sometimes they're just summarizing what he said, and they summarize it differently. That's all. Don't think necessarily about the quote marks. Okay, here's some other differences. Sometimes there's a difference in number. Sometimes there's a difference in number. In Matthew chapter 8, verse 28, he comes up to the demoniacs. How many demoniacs from Gerasa are there? You remember the story. There's this guy who comes out. He's cutting himself. He's in the graveyard. Cutting himself, they bind him with chains, he snaps the chains, nobody can bind the guy. And the guy, or I should say guys too, there's two demoniacs in Matthew chapter 8, and Jesus comes up and he's going to cast them out. This is legion. They say, please cast us into the pigs, and the pigs then run down the hill and get drowned in the Sea of Galilee. And so in Matthew chapter 8, there are two demoniacs of Gerasa. And so Jesus casts the demons out of two guys. When you go to Mark, Mark has the story in chapter 5, verse 2. There's one demoniac, and this demoniac, Jesus, casts a demon legion out of him. He goes back home and tells of the great things God has done for them. So in the resurrection, therefore, will there be two demoniacs or one demoniac? And I guess, you know, you say, well, that's not really the point. Okay, there could have been, is it possible there could have been three or four? It's possible there could have been three or four, and that Matthew only tells us about two of them. Or it's possible there's only, you know, one of them and things like that. And I just say, I mean, how many of you, when you tell, well, let's put it this way, let's put it back in your face. How many of you, when you tell your parents what happened, and you were out at some party or something at night, and you went out and, you know, you're on the town and stuff like that, do you tell part or do you tell the whole story? Do you tell part of the story or do you tell the whole story? Well, you tell the part that you think your parents would want to hear, and you don't tell the other part. And so it's now question, are you lying to them? No, you're not lying to them. You just didn't tell them everything that happened that night because you don't want to get in trouble or whatever. And so you just tell part of the story. You don't tell the whole story. So it's possible that here we have a part-whole issue. He tells part of the story. There's two guys, and the other guy tells a story. There's one guy, and he's just not giving you the full story. There could have been three or four there, but he's just telling you, focusing on two. And in one case in Mark, he's focusing on one. Had a woman in the class this year, and she brought up the fact, she says, well, even as a parent, does a parent always tell their kids the whole story? And that's not true, too, that oftentimes parents tell the kids just part of the story, and the kids then, it's not appropriate for them to know everything that went on, say, in a certain situation. And I know I'm debating in my own head now, and our kids, normally my wife and I fight, like, I mean, anybody who's married, you're going to know how to fight. My wife and I, usually when we fight, we made a practice not of fighting in front of our kids. So my kids have never really seen my wife and I really go at it and get into a conflict and things like that. Because we usually, when we fight, we go upstairs, close the door, and then we have it out. Or we do it away from the kids and things. And I'm debating now whether that was a smart thing to do or whether it was a dumb thing to do as a parent, okay? Is it good to show your kids how to resolve conflict and stuff and do it in front of them? Or is it good to, you know, do it separately so that they don't see it? Well, then the impression is that maybe the parents don't fight. Well, my kids probably know better than that. But it just, I don't know, goes back and forth. One of the girls in the class this year said that in her family, her parents fought in front of her. And as a little kid, she always wondered, you know, did I cause the fight? And so then she takes on a lot of the weight then is thinking that she caused it when it had nothing whatsoever to do with her. So you got to be really careful about those kind of things. But all I'm saying is, as parents, don't tell their kids everything that's going on. We're in financial difficulty or something like that. We don't lay those financial difficulties on our kids and things. And so it's inappropriate for them to know about certain things. And so, and kids, of course, and from your perspective as college students, you know, you don't tell your parents everything either. And so part whole kinds of things, number variation in this case, two demoniacs, one demoniac, part whole kind of things. Timing variations, and now this brings up a big one, timing variations. And I want to look at here one particular instance of this. And this has to do with the temple cleansing. And John, now we're going to be comparing John here. John has the temple cleansing where Jesus goes in and flips over the table in the temple and drives out the shopkeepers and things and take the doves out of here kind of thing. Jesus does that in John chapter 2, which is right at the beginning of the book of John. John doesn't have any of the birth stories about Jesus. He starts, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God and the Word was God. Boom, he jumps right into this thing of Jesus is the Word, the Logos. And then, boom, chapter 2. Jesus makes water into wine, and Jesus flips over the table. And then you've got the whole rest of the book of John going on when Jesus cleanses one of the first things he does in the book of John. Yet in Matthew, the story of the temple cleansing comes at the end. When Jesus is up at the temple, and he's going to be, his last week, his passion week, when he's going to be tried and crucified, and he does the temple cleansing just after just before his crucifixion. And here, this is interesting too. What about the fig tree? The fig tree. In Matthew, Jesus condemns the fig tree and it withers immediately. Whereas in the book of Mark, when Jesus curses the fig tree withers the next day. So this is a timing variation. Okay, we're talking about differences in timing. The temple cleansing, was it at the beginning or end of Christ's ministry? This withering of the fig tree. Jesus curses the fig tree. He goes up to the fig tree, there's no fruit on it. He curses it. In Matthew, boom, the fig tree withers immediately. But in Mark, it's the next day when the fig tree withers. Now, okay, what about this timing variation? And I think this is fairly significant here. Okay? Let me just talk about this a little bit further. I'm just wondering. Let me just go down a little bit here and see. Yeah, let's deal with the temple cleansing. Okay? Let me come back here and just... we've got another, people say, contradiction here, where in one, Jesus is sending out the 12, and in one, he says, don't take a staff, and, you know, just go out, don't take staff, don't take anything with you, just live off the people of the land kind of thing. And the other one, he says, take a staff with you. So there's a difference between Matthew chapter 10, verse 10, Mark chapter 6, verse 8. And as this people are, this is pretty easily solved, I think. Did Jesus send the 12 out repeatedly, probably? Did Jesus send the 12 out in various contexts? And so one time he told them, take a staff. The other one he tells them, don't take a staff. It could be, even, that he's got some people who are he's sending out into Galilee, and he tells those people, don't take a staff, because you're going to Galilee, you should be friends with the people there. And he's telling these other guys, hey, they're going over to the Decapolis area, and hey, you're going to need a staff over there. So it's possible that he tells, you know, some of his disciples to take a staff, and some of them not to take a staff, okay? So you've got either that scenario where he's sending them to two different regions, and he's telling one group to take a staff and one not to, in the same event. Or you could have it that Jesus sends out the 12, and then we know all other places he sends out the 70. And so Jesus sending out people repeatedly and with different advice each time, and that's possible. So this is not really a contradiction. You can explain it in various ways. Now, I want to talk about the temple cleansing. And, yeah, actually, you know, I want to tell you a story. Let me come back to this one with the staff, to take a staff or not to take a staff. And one he tells them, do take a staff. The other one he tells them, do not take a staff. I think it was Kenneth Conser tells this story about a person. And I want to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you, told by two eyewitnesses. These are two people who saw this accident, okay? So you've got two eyewitnesses of an accident, okay? Here's how it goes. The first witnesses. This is the first witness reports to the police. This is what happened. It was a bus. Bus came down the road. The woman was standing by a telephone pole. The bus hit the pole and threw the woman and hit the woman. The bus hit the telephone pole, hit the woman, threw the woman, and the woman was hurt, not fatally. The woman was hurt, not fatally, and she was taken to the hospital. Okay? So the bus hits the pole, hits the woman. The woman is hurt, not fatally, and taken to the hospital. That's what the one witness saw. Here's a description of a second witness. Second witness says, the woman was in a car. The car was T-boned. She was not wearing her seatbelt. She was thrown out of the car and killed instantly. Okay? She was in a car without her seatbelt. She was hit, T-boned, and she was thrown out of the car and killed instantly. Now, which one of those stories is true? Very different stories, right? Very different stories. One by a telephone pole, she's not hurt fatally, she's taken to the hospital. The other one, she's killed instantly, thrown out of the car. Okay? Two different stories. Sound like these are two different witnesses. It sounds like the stories are contradictory. They're not. The problem is, whenever you have a story, you're not, you know, the full story, life is more complex. This is just a kind of a dumb thing to say. But life is more complex than a story. What happened with this woman? Here's how this worked out. This is actual truth. Okay, this actually happened. Okay, two witnesses, okay? One, the woman was standing by a pole. She was hit by the bus and she was injured. A good Samaritan stopped his car, picked up the woman, and was taking her to the hospital. As he was taking her to the hospital, she did not put on her seatbelt, and the guy went through an intersection while he was taking her to the hospital, and he was T-boned, and she was ejected from the inside of his car, and she was killed instantly. So question, which witness was right? They both were right, okay? The story's actually, the problem was, well, the story was much more complex than initially. You think that the stories are like this, and you realize that there was a time sequence there, and that solves that problem. And so all I'm saying is, when you got to be careful when you come to Scripture Life is much more complicated. We're getting a fraction of what happened. We're getting a fraction of what Jesus said. And we're getting a fraction of the situation. We don't know the whole situation all the time. So you got to be careful about making these big judgments. Oh, there's contradictions in the Bible. See, this contradicts this. He told him to take a staff. He told him not to take a staff. You weren't there, man. So you don't know. You don't know exactly what was going on. Did he send them to two different areas? Did he tell them to take a staff one time and then not another time? You weren't there. And so don't go, you know what I'm saying? The Bible is proven reliable enough all the time on the stuff that we know that where there's conflict, you got to be able to say, hey, you know, I trust the witness. I know I've seen the Bible tell the truth 100 million times. And so if it's got this thing that looks like a contradiction, there's got to be some sort of explanation to it. So be careful. Life is more complex than what's recorded in Scripture. Indeed, John tells us, sorry for jumping to John, but John says, if I wrote down everything that Jesus ever did, he says all the books in the world couldn't hold it all. So, of course, you're just getting part of what Jesus said and did. Okay. So just that kind of as a background there. Now, what I'd like to do is look at this temple cleansing, because I think this is really pretty interesting. I want to run through this, okay? This temple cleansing, Jesus flipping over the tables, is found in all four Gospels. And so I want to look at it in all four Gospels because they give us different narrations of what happened, when it happened, and that kind of thing. And what I want to ask is this. What is the function of the temple cleansing story in each Gospel? How does the temple cleansing function in each Gospel writer? How does he use the temple cleansing when he tells that story? How does he frame the story in that context and things? So, what we're going to see is that one frames the story of the gospel of the cleansing of the temple in a religious, priestly, or purity of the temple kind of way, that there's a violation of the purity of the temple. A second way will be a social justice way, where we'll see Jesus comes in and flips over the tables and cleanses the temple so that he can teach. So that he can teach. He is the sage teacher. And he comes and the pilgrims are there coming to his teaching. And so that'll be framed that way. Another one frames it as Jesus is flipping over the tables and kicking them out as a messianic king. And as the messianic king, and this is his temple, he's cleansing it up as a messianic king, redefining the temple. Redefining the temple that he's cleansing, the temple becomes the temple of his body, and that his body is the focus here, the temple of his body. And then lastly, one of the writers will take this temple cleansing as a pronouncement, as a prophetic announcement. Get these things out of here, as Jesus is participating in this prophetic kind of pronouncement, and then the rejection of the prophet. Same way that they rejected Isaiah, the same way they rejected Jeremiah and Ezekiel. They reject Jesus now in the temple area as he makes this prophetic. Actually, Jeremiah was one who was in the temple and he would give him these prophecies and then people would wail on him and beat him and stuff. Jeremiah had a rough time, but Jesus, it's this prophet in the temple making a pronouncement and then being rejected and the judgment then the judgment coming on the temple. If you remember Jeremiah makes these prophecies that Babylon's coming in and is going to destroy the place. And then basically people get all upset. They reject Jeremiah. They beat up Jeremiah and stuff like that. And what you have then is this judgment on the temple comes. And Nebuchadnezzar in 586 comes and wipes out the temple exactly like Jeremiah said. Jeremiah said Nebuchadnezzar would come and the Babylonians would wipe it out, destroy it. And indeed they did. With Jesus, you got the same thing. He cleanses the temple, says basically that the temple is going to be destroyed. And sure enough, 70 AD, Titus and the Romans come in and level the temple. All I'm trying to say here is the story of the cleansing of the temple is told in four different ways. And so let's kind of lay that out now. The prophetic rejection. Now look at how Mark frames the story of the temple cleansing. Look at how Mark frames the story. He frames it with the cursing of the fig tree. So Jesus comes up to the temple, but before he gets to the temple, he curses this fig tree. The fig tree stands for Israel, and that Israel has not got any fruit, and it should have fruit or something, and Jesus curses it. The temple is cleared, this incident, in Mark chapter 11, verse 15, thereabouts. And then the outcome Jesus cleanses the temple. The outcome is the crowds are amazed. And in the book of Mark, you've got the crowds, you've got the amazement. Mark seems to be writing to a Roman audience, and so this fits perfectly. He cleanses the temple. The crowds are amazed, and the other people want to kill him. The religious leaders want to kill him. And so what you've got here is basically, this is the rejection of the prophet by the leaders of the country. And the leaders of the country reject it, and they seek to kill Jesus when he's framed. Then what happens? Okay, so he clears the temple. There's these two very different reactions. And then what happens? The fig tree withers. At the end, you come back in chapter 11, verse 20 in Mark. They go out again and they see that the fig tree is withered. So here it starts with the fig tree being cursed, and then the story ends with the fig tree withering. And you see Mark then frames kind of like an envelope, or as Dr. Phillips would say, an inclusio. An inclusio, it begins with the cursing of the fig tree, and then the fig tree withers. And that the fig tree then encapsulates, like bookends, encapsulates the story of the temple cleansing, largely to illustrate this point of the prophet's rejection. Jesus comes in as a prophet into the temple, and he is rejected, and they try to kill him and things. And so the tree withers because what? The tree represents Israel, that Israel's rejection of the message will result in the withering of the fig tree. So this is how Mark frames the story, as a prophetic rejection. Okay, prophetic rejection. So it's more in line with Isaiah 56:7 and Jeremiah chapter 7. So Mark frames it with this kind of quote, you know, get these things out of my house, don't make my father's house into a den of thieves kind of thing. Now let's look at the other one. Let's look at Matthew chapter 21. Now in Matthew, you remember, is about the kingdom of heaven. And so Matthew will portray this temple cleansing and the idea of a messianic restoration of the temple area. And so basically, let's look at the context and how it flows. Jesus in chapter 21, Matthew chapter 21, Jesus comes into the temple area. How does he get there? He's riding on a donkey. The people are all singing, Hosanna, Hosanna, to the king. And there's Palm Sunday, Matthew chapter 21, Palm Sunday, riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, the son of David coming in. Hosanna, Hosanna to the highest, okay? Then Jesus what? Jesus comes as the messianic, as the Messiah. He comes into the temple and he cleanses the temple. That's the role of the Messiah, to make things right. And so he cleanses the temple, chapter 21, verse 12. In the book of Matthew, he flips over the tables and drives them out. And there's Hosannas. The Hosannas continue, and Jesus then, in the book of Matthew, Jesus flips over the table, he cleanses the temple, and then what should the Messiah do? The Messiah should heal people in the Temple Mount. So there's all these healings that Jesus does in the Son of David. The people cry out, Son of David. And from the lips of children, you've ordained praise, Jesus says. And so what you have in the book of Matthew is Jesus flips over the table and the messianic restoration. Jesus heals people and he takes that which is broken and he fixes it and he fixes people and stuff. The Messiah restores things to the way it should be. You get a glimpse of the kingdom that is not yet becoming already here when Jesus is here. Jesus is the king. He is the messianic ruler. And so therefore he cleanses the temple and he heals people. He brings the kingdom to the now. The already but not yet, as Dr. Matheson used to say so much, okay, the already but not yet. And so you get a glimpse of the not yet, but Jesus doing it already here as he heals these people and restores and cleanses the temple. So the messianic restoration and the city's hosannas and things clearly seen here in the book of Matthew. The lame are healed, the outsiders are brought in. And this is the messianic kingdom. You get a glimpse in Matthew, you get a glimpse of the kingdom of heaven on earth. And Matthew portrays this in the temple cleansing. The insiders, however, the outsiders are brought in, but the insiders become opponents. And this is a minor role, though, here in things. And then the next day, the fig tree is withered. In other words, the fig tree is not the point here. He's showing the messianic restoration kind of thing. And so the fig tree is disconnected from the temple cleansing. And rather, the fig tree is used in Matthew as a lesson on prayer. The fig tree is used as a lesson on prayer in the book of Matthew. So Matthew uses the fig tree in conjunction with these things, but he uses it for a different function and shows Jesus' temple cleansing is actually the Messiah, a messianic restoration, especially featuring the healing of the people. Now, what do we have here in Luke? In Luke, it's interesting, in chapter 19, verse 45 and following, Luke's got the temple cleansing. And what does Jesus do? Jesus flips over the table, but then instead of healing people and making things in this messianic kingdom, giving you a glimpse of the kingdom, here you've got Jesus teaching in the temple. And so basically it's in the context of Jesus' lament for Jerusalem. Jesus comes over the Mount of Olives and he's going to go into the temple area. As he comes over the Mount of Olives, Jesus weeps and he says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you know, how many times as a mother hen I would have gathered you as chicks into my arms, but you would not. And he laments, you guys have seen in the Get Lost in Jerusalem program, the Dominus Flavit, the church where Jesus wept. The church itself is shaped like a tear. And it's on the Mount of Olives as you come down to Jerusalem across the Kidron Valley. And so the lament for Jerusalem, and this is foreshadowing. What is this a foreshadowing? The day of the Lord. This foreshadowing, the destruction of Jerusalem. God is coming to you. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. The day of the Lord is coming. And basically, he mutes the incident. There's no reference to the money changers, the doves. There's no detail to, you know, take the doves. The doves got special treatment, driving the people out. There's no reference to the money changers and things. He mutes the incident of the temple cleansing. Now, why does he mute the incident of the temple cleansing, the flipping over the tables and things like that? Instead of the flipping over the tables, the driving out the money tax collectors, and, you know, this kind of stuff, and the doves take special treatment with the doves and stuff, it's taken as an example of Jesus as the sage whose teaching function, and it's through Jesus' teaching function that the audience is split. So Jesus is the teacher in Luke. He's a messianic teacher. He's a sage teacher. It's very interesting to me, and this year is, I think, the first year I made this connection with it, with Luke. Luke is the only gospel. Do you remember when Jesus was 12 years old and he went? They took him up to the temple for his bar mitzvah or whatever it was? And then they leave, and they leave Jesus behind. This is kind of the first Left Behind series, okay? So Jesus is left behind, and his mother and father leave, and then all of a sudden they get like 2 or 3 days out and say, hey, where's Jesus, man? Nobody knows where he is. Says, oh, man, we lost him and stuff. So they go back to Jerusalem, and they go what? They go into the temple area, and what's Jesus? Jesus is sitting there, what? Listening and teaching people in the temple area. And then his parents come up, you know, hey, we were worried to death about you. What are you doing, man? And Jesus says, hey, I should be about my father's business, right? His father's business in the temple. And so Luke starts in, I think it's Luke chapter 2 or 3 in there. He starts with Jesus as teacher in the temple. And then how does Luke end in chapter 19 here? He comes at the end of his book. He also comes back to Jesus now cleansing the temple and being the messianic teacher now as a, you know, 30, 32-year-old person. So this is, it's kind of a neat way that Luke, both when Jesus is 12 and then when Jesus just before his Passion Week, that he features this Jesus as sage, Jesus as wise teacher kind of thing. And that's Luke. So Luke tells the same story, the temple cleansing. He downplays certain of the details that are forefronted in the other Gospels, and instead Luke forefronts Jesus' teaching as sage. Okay, now I think we've lost our power here up front, but Matthew, let me just do John and without the screen up and just do John and we'll just describe what happens in John. In John, Jesus comes and says, flips over all the tables and cleanses the temple. But at John puts the temple cleansing early. John puts the temple cleansing early, so it's almost in chapter 2 of John. This is how Jesus starts his ministry. But then Jesus says what? He flips over all the tables. What right do you do this? And Jesus says, destroy this temple. In 3 days, I'll raise it up. Well, what temple is he talking about? Jesus is flipping over the table and saying, you know, destroy this temple, and in 3 days, I'll lift it up kind of thing. Okay? 3 days, I'll lift it up. He's talking about the temple of his body. So when Jesus, in John, when Jesus flips over the tables, there's a transition from the temple cleansing to the temple of his body, and then in 3 days he'll raise it from the dead. By the way, is that issue that John raises, that in 3 days he'll raise it from the dead, is that a really important issue for the Jews? Yes, it is. Because do you remember on Jesus' trial when he comes before Caiaphas, there's some witnesses come forward and they said, on what basis should we accuse Jesus? On what basis should we accuse Jesus? Because he said he would destroy the temple and raise it up in 3 days. Did they not get it, that he was talking about the temple of his body? But then he raises from the dead the temple of his body 3 days later after the resurrection. And so what you have in John then is John starts his gospel explaining to the Jews that he's not talking about the temple there. He's talking about the temple of his body. And when he raises from the dead, then his disciples put it together. Whoa, okay, that's what he was talking about. But they misunderstood. And so John is basically short-circuiting this Jewish misunderstanding of Jesus, that Jesus was going to destroy the temple. That's not the point. The point for the Jewish people, we realize the temple is the temple of his body. And so John puts that right initially. And so John puts Jesus' temple cleansing in the temple of, in that shift, that the temple that he's talking about is the temple of his body. So what you have then is in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Luke is the sage teacher. Mark is the prophetic rejection. Matthew was something on the kingdom, and Luke and John, and John was the temple of his body. So they use the story of the temple cleansing is used in four different ways, according to the writer. And it's just absolutely beautiful how each writer crafts the story of the temple cleansing and puts it in a different context and gives it a different flavor and things and sees it from a different perspective. Even as, and let me just use one more example and we'll quit with this. How many refs do you have in a basketball game? How many refs do you have in a basketball game? Do you ever have just one ref? No, you don't have one ref. You have two or three refs because you need different perspectives. One ref may see, you know, if somebody goes up and gets hit from one side, the other guy didn't see him and he whacked him with his hip and that's why the guy went flying and stuff. But the other guy, from the different perspective, and if you've ever watched referees, you'll notice that they work different aspects of the court so that they can see different from a different perspective. And so what you've got is the gospel writers telling the same story, but they're like refs. They're looking from different perspectives. So as you need multiple refs in a basketball game. So you've got, three gospel writers. They see Christ with the same eye. They're telling many of the same stories and things. John's giving a very different story. But they're, even among the three, they're using the story and they're seeing the story in a different light. So that's part of the synoptic problem. And next time we'll develop a little bit more of this further. Okay? Thanks.
This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his New Testament History, Literature, and Theology course. Lecture number 15, finishing up on prayer in the book of Luke in the Emmaus Road, and then proceeding into the synoptic problem.